Today on Against the Grain, the struggle at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline brought international attention to the resistance of Native peoples against the destruction of the environment. But that resistance has been going on for centuries. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Dina Gilio Whitaker about why ecological struggles have been central to Native struggles and about the complicated relationship between the U.S. environmental movement and Native peoples. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The U.S. environmental movement has had a shameful history of racism. Nowhere has that been more apparent than in its founders' support for the dispossession of Native peoples in the late 19th and 20th centuries. Yet despite that appalling past in the name of environmentalism, Native people themselves have their own histories of struggle in defense of nature. In her book, As Long as the Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock, published by Beacon Press, Dina Gilio Whitaker explores these two threads of environmental history. She's a lecturer in American Indian Studies at California State San Marcos and is also a descendant of the Colville Confederated Tribes. Dina, you write that Native people and what many of us would think of as the environmental movement have a complicated and fraught history. We'll talk much more extensively about this relationship, of course, as we go through the hour, but can you tell us in a nutshell why that is?
It goes back to the beginning, as I argue in the book, the beginning of the environmental movement to what we might call first wave environmentalism with the conservation and preservation movement, which starts with the creation of the national park system back in the 1870s. And, you know, when we look at that history, it's a history of Native land dispossession because as I follow the work of Mark David Spence in that history, you know, he made it clear in his study that the creation of these parks was really all about a recasting or a defining of what wilderness is. So if the national parks were about protecting wilderness, as he says, the wilderness first had to be created. So so if you follow that line of reasoning, it's really deeply connected to this period of time, which, you know, coincides with the Indian Wars. The Indian Wars are happening seriously on the plains, and the military is going after plains people who are resisting the confinement onto reservations. And so so it's all part of that era. And so Native people, and it really starts with the establishment of Yellowstone and Glacier National Park, and then the third one is with Yosemite here in California. So so it's all about, and then actually they have different histories, the way Yellowstone and Glacier dispossess Native people compared to Yosemite, which actually allows Native people to remain in order to actually use them as sort of marketing gimmicks for the park. So different kinds of histories, but ultimately pretty exclusive.
Tell us a bit more about that period in the 19th century when the dispossession of Native Americans was in full swing, so to speak, and the ideologies that dominated at the time and how those influenced people like John Muir, who is revered by some environmentalists now as the father of conservation.
Yeah, it goes back to, and I write about this quite a bit in the book, it goes back to this idea that was really a foundational kind of principle in the United States, with the creating of American Indian people, this narrative of indigenous inferiority. It's that Native people are, it's this dehumanizing kind of narrative that Native people are, they're uncivilized, they're savage, they are really unfit to be in possession of all this land. And so early in the 19th century, with the early Indian law cases beginning in 1823, the Supreme Court starts laying out these ideas that then become the foundation for dispossessing, this process of dispossession. And so this idea that Native people are really unintelligent, they're childlike, they are uncivilized, it's really like just written straight through American the social landscape of this country. I mean, even Henry David Thoreau felt that through all of his idolizing of Native peoples, he still ultimately believes that Indian people are destined to die out because they need to, you know, they're just too primitive. So John Muir, who was, you know, of course, very influenced by Thoreau, also, I mean, he's not even as generous as Thoreau. I mean, John Muir, just his experience with Indians in California is he's incredibly racist. And it's written through all of his work. And he just finds Native people, Native California, he calls them digger Indians, which, of course, was a pejorative even then. And he just finds them completely unsatisfactory in all kinds of ways. So it's this deep, I would call it racism, but it's really, I mean, it's partly about racism, but it really goes back to the very earliest days of European settlement on the continent and its connection to Christianity, because it's really about the way Christianity and the early Catholic Church doctrines, going back to these papal bulls, that establish this cultural and religious superiority. So it begins, this inferiorizing of indigenous peoples begins as a religious kind of doctrine.
Well, if we were to see Native peoples and their history as being centrally tied up with what we might describe as the destruction of the environment, what would that history look like in very broad terms?
The destruction of the environment, it goes hand in hand with the destruction of cultures. And the reason that it does is because Native people are so deeply connected to their lands for their physical survival, but not just for their physical survival, but also for their cultural survival. Who they understand themselves to be as people is directly connected to the places that they emerge from. So when you forcibly remove people from these places, you remove them from their ways of understanding themselves and what has been called their relations of responsibility and their ability to exercise collective continuance, in the words of Kyle White. So it's connected on all these different levels, and it reflects this kind of holistic way that Native people are connected to the environment and spiritually connected, but physically connected, where they need the environment to survive physically, but also this very deeply religious, which is a very problematic word, but the ways that all of these things are inseparable from each other.
Well, obviously it's complicated to make generalizations across nations, Native nations, which have particular histories in particular areas. But If you were able to talk in broad terms, what would you say that kind of environmental destruction looked like in the 19th century for Native peoples?
Well, it looked like a bunch of different kinds of things. In terms of the destruction of the environment itself, I mean, the most obvious example is with the eradication of the buffalo on the plains. I think most people are pretty well aware of that history of the eradication of the buffalo as a formal policy in order to starve Indians out of those, that sort of migratory kind of pattern and onto the reservations. So, you know, we see the destruction of the buffalo population almost complete, with, you know, as few as 1,000 buffalo left by the end of the 19th century. In other places of the country, like where I'm from, on the Colville Reservation up in the northern Columbia Plateau and also southern Columbia Plateau, you see the destruction of salmon fisheries. And that comes a little bit later. That comes more in the 20th century, early 20th century, with the intensification of infrastructure building, particularly with dams. And so this push in the early 20th century to build dams, which is part of the economic recovery from the Depression, with the Works Progress Administration, all these kinds of projects to revitalize the economy, we see this massive dam building kind of project happening in a bunch of different places. And the Columbia River is one such place, as is the Missouri River with the Pick-Sloan Act that caused so much destruction to the Sioux people and their way of life, which is what the Standing Rock protest partly was about. But on the Columbia Plateau, you have the building of 60-some dams all in that entire watershed, and it causes the flooding of these ancient fisheries that were places of massive salmon population and salmon runs. And it's been so extreme that we have almost a near extinction of several salmon species. So this is a problem that is also manifest in California, in Northern California, with up on the Klamath River and others. And so this is ongoing environmental devastation that's been carried through for, you know, over a century in many places.
And we'll speak more about how that has affected people in the present. I should say that I'm speaking with Dina Gillia Whitaker. She is a lecturer of American Indian Studies at Cal State University, San Marcos, and she's the author of As Long as the Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. That's published by Beacon Press. And you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You mentioned earlier the connection between environmentalism, the environmental movement, and particularly the conservation movement in the late 19th century, and parks. And I wondered if you could expand on that a bit more in the context of what you've just been tracing, which is the kinds of dispossession that took place in the 19th century. For people who don't know the history of how the national parks fit into that story, can you explain what happened?
So the establishment of the national park system is really, it really comes out of this movement to conserve these, you know, quote unquote wild natural places. And the thing is, you know, going back to that idea of the wilderness having to first be created, is that this is a conception of wilderness that's divorced from any kind of human connection to it. So wilderness always means people are not part of it. They are separate from it. And so as this sort of idea builds from throughout the late 19th century, early 20th century. In the as the turn of the century happens, we see this sort of new sensibility of preserving these wild spaces, and we see as sort of the proto-environmentalist movement, you know, or what they call first wave environmentalism. And in the early 20th century, we see the establishment of other agencies within the federal government that are in laws like the Antiquities Act of 1906. We see the establishment of numerous kinds of organizations, you know, private and public organizations, you know, committed to the preservation of these spaces. Because what's happening is the country, the frontier is closed, right? That whole frontier narrative, the frontier is closed. We are seeing intense urbanization all over the continent, from the East Coast to the West Coast. And so it becomes a matter of how do we manage the wild spaces, you know, quote unquote, that are still left in the country. And again, you know, Native people being confined to these reservations that are enforced by treaties. And so it's this enclosing, this process of enclosing, or, you know, what's been called the creation of these islands, which some of the reservations were sometimes referred to as. So Native people, and it's part of also the assimilation process. That's what's happening in federal Indian policy at the time, is that Native people, you know, they're finally contained. The Indian Wars end, you know, around the 1890s. And so Native people are contained. And, you know, we have the Dawes Act, which is all about privatizing those communally held tribal lands. So tribes have always held land communally, but in order to, you know, impose the civilizing project on Native people, it had to be about instilling the values of individualism in Native people on an individual basis. Sometimes it's called sort of detribalizing the Native people and instilling them, and they actually use this language, instilling in them the values of selfishness. And so that they would understand the concept of private land ownership. And so the reservations are partitioned off, they become privatized. It's called allotment, and so this is happening at the same time. The Dawes Act mandates this federal boarding school system that are run by churches, and so this process is happening. The children are being taken from their homes, going to these boarding schools. The lands are becoming privatized, and in 1924 the Citizenship Act happens, and Native people are officially declared citizens of the United States. So it's understanding the big picture of what's happening in the country at this time that the environmental movement in the form of the preservation and conservation movement is happening. So, you know, it's making those connections that are all about, you know, this expansionism, the rise of the Industrial Revolution, and federal Indian policy, which is about assimilating and ultimately eliminating Native people from their landscapes.
Well, talk more about the Industrial Revolution as a factor in this, because you say that two key elements was the Western expansion, and at a certain point, you know, the frontier was closed. How did the Industrial Revolution bear on the dispossession of Native peoples and the environmental degradation in a Native context?
The Industrial Revolution is tied to this building of the infrastructure of the United States. And, you know, part of it is about the containing of water. and the building of these dams. So that's part of it. But also you start seeing the mass extraction of resources from the land. I mean, in you know, we can talk more about that, but and as I do in the book, in the extraction of uranium becomes a huge problem for Native people. And it begins in the 1930s. So the 1930s, you start seeing the mining of uranium in the Southwest. And, you know, by the time the 1940s roll around and the Manhattan Project is in full swing, you see this massive project to extract uranium up on the Colorado Plateau. And that's the home of the Navajo Nation and other Pueblo nations. And then you see it also in the Dakotas, in South Dakota, you see, and not just South Dakota, but also on the Columbia Plateau as well, with two major uranium mines and the building of the Hanford processing plant on the Columbia River. So this ends up, these incredibly toxic extractive processes end up becoming part of what I frame as this genocidal, this structural genocidal process that affects Native people. It affects not only their lands, but of course that all you know, filters down into the level of the individual body of Native people, the bodies of Native peoples. The poisoning of the land is always about the poisoning of people for Native people. So it's rendering, as Tracy Voiles talks about in her book Wastelanding, where she looks at this deep history of uranium mining in the Southwest. It's about how this process of uranium extraction because it's known to be incredibly toxic. They've known that since the 1930s, and yet they take these companies, Kerr McGee especially, go to the Navajo Nation and they mine this uranium because it's a cheap source of labor. It's a place where they don't have to have labor standards, no protections. For years, those Navajo people were sent into those mines without any kind of protective gear whatsoever. And so in this process, is what Tracy Voiles calls this, the rendering of Native bodies is expendable. They're pollutable, just like the land is considered wasteland. So this process of wastelanding is also a process of wastelanding bodies, in a sense, because they're not as valuable as other people's bodies. And so this is, it's not so much a process of dispossession, but I mean, I suppose it could be in to the extent that Native people are expendable. You know, if you are going to send them into these extremely toxic processes of extraction, knowing full well that they're going to be exposed to toxification that can kill them, then I suppose we could see that as a process of dispossessing them of their health. I mean, I haven't really written about it in that way, but it's certainly a way that we could think about it.
Well, what do we know about the health consequences for Native people of uranium mining and other extractivist industries?
Well, uranium mining is famous for being cancer causing.
Sure.
You know, yeah, we don't, everybody pretty much knows that. And I mean, it's a horrible process that nobody wants anything to do with. We understand the problems with nuclear plants, for example, and the waste that it produces. Anything involving uranium is going to have processes that last for thousands of years. Like, that stuff doesn't go away. And when it's exposed, it's exposed. And on places like the Colorado Plateau and the Columbia Plateau, where so much mining was done, These places don't go away. Like you can almost not clean them up. So like on the Navajo reservation right now, you have at least 1300 mines, places that were mined that were never cleaned up, places that uranium tailings are still open to the elements. There are like open sores on the land where people still inhabit, places where children play, places where the water is contaminated and the wind blows and it just blows. And so this stuff becomes airborne. And so that's still happening on the Navajo Nation right now. There was a project to clean. There were funds. It was a settlement that happened just a few years ago to involving the company that was Kerr McGee, and it's, I don't remember the name of the company now, became something else. But there was a multi-billion-dollar settlement to fund the cleanup of some of these mines, but the amount of money that was settled for was enough to only clean up like 49 of those mines. So 49 out of 1300 mines will get cleaned up. That means the rest of them will still be there, still toxifying the environment and toxifying the people in those lands.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with the author of As Long as the Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. That's published by Beacon Press, and you can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. Its author is Dina Gillia Whitaker. She's a descendant of Colville Confederated Tribes. She's also the co-author with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz of All the Real Indians Died Off. So you have mentioned the sort of, in some sense, inconceivable health consequences of the destruction of native lands, including through things like uranium mining. Whenever one sees indices for health based on different groups, native people almost always are at the bottom. What do we know about the health of Native people, given the kind of history you've been tracing and the present?
So I think, and I argue, that the health consequences that Native people experience today, all these negative indices, are directly traceable to the environment. Even if we're talking about problems like diabetes and heart disease, which are the worst, you know, and all that, that's connected to obesity. That's all directly related to the environment because of this history of dispossession. Part of the dispossession that happened to Native peoples was cutting them off from their traditional food sources. So, you know, assimilation was about assimilating them into mainstream American society, which was every bit connected to assimilating them to the American diet. And that really begins in the early reservation period with the cutting off, first of all, of, you know, a hunting lifestyle for those that were, and all Native peoples were hunters to one degree or another. Many tribes were agricultural, but for the hunting people who had a migratory kind of seasonal round based food system, when that's cut off and they're confined to reservations, they are reliant upon federal food rations. So not being allowed off the reservation to hunt meant that they had to rely on the food rations. The food rations were always white flour, sugar, lard, and coffee, and really basic basic foods like that, really highly refined, low nutrition foods. And then later on, so that happens around the turn of the century. But And so during those years of the first part of the 20th century, they're getting used to these new kinds of foods. They're unable to hunt and continue their seasonal round style of collecting food. And so starvation is rampant. And that's when the health problems really start showing up, and it becomes identified in this study called the Merriam Report in 1928. And so that leads to some change in federal policy, and we see the Indian Reorganization Act passed in 1934 that sort of loosens up the constraints on tribal nations being able to govern themselves. But these health problems continue. And so by the 1960s, we have, you know, the war on poverty in the United States as a new policy. And with the war on poverty, we see the creation of these new health programs and food programs. You know, the food stamp program gets created during this time. And so, you know, again, we see that native health conditions are really bad on the reservations. And so they create the commodity food program. The commodity food program was similar to the food rations of the late 19th century, in that these foods were sent to the reservations. They were, again, really highly processed foods, a lot of pasta, a lot of cheese, cereals, canned meats, things like that. And astonishingly, within one generation, Indian country goes from being malnourished to being obese. And again, it's traced back to the cutting off of native peoples from their traditional foods, because the studies show, like, unequivocally that traditional foods were incredibly highly nutritious, and it's not only the nutritious value of the foods, but it's the wide variety of foods that native people relied on that ensured very, very robust health. So native people were some of the most healthy people on the planet. I mean, they were more healthy than Europeans at the time, because of this really diverse diet that they had. It was nutritionally complete. They were just really robust in their health, because of the lifestyle too. When you are out on the land and you're gathering food and you're farming, you are active. You don't have the sedentary life that we were forced into in the 20th century. So all of these things combined lead to this sort of deeply rooted problem of health in Indian country, that which is also why we have a food systems movement that's really taking off in Indian country, and people taking, you know, tribal nations taking control of their food systems and doing food sovereignty projects and growing more of their own food and going back to traditional foods as much as possible as a way to fight these health problems.
I wanted to ask you about, following the thread of how the environmental movement, the mainstream environmental movement in the United States, has related to Native peoples. And that history is long, as you've illustrated. But I wanted to ask you particularly about the period of the 1960s and the counterculture. This is a time when a lot of young people turn toward Native culture in a particular way, both celebrating it, but also really distorting it. Tell us about how the counterculture saw Native people and how it shaped the larger perceptions in the wider U.S. society about Native people.
So because Native people, the image and the knowledge of Native peoples is so distorted in the American social and cultural landscape, this this image of Native people as inferior and ultimately disappearing, right? That's part of this whole conversation about the disappearing, vanishing Indian who is destined to vanish into the mists of time due to his, you know, inferiority and lack of evolution as modern people. So that's happening during the first part of the 20th century. And by the second half of the 20th century, we have, the Cultural Revolution. And it's really being led by, you know, disaffected white youth. The counterculture is a white middle-class youth movement. That's this mass rebellion against the conservative values of their parents' generation. And so this sort of spiritual bankruptcy is part of that, you know, feeling like this intensely capitalist society is not working for them. And we're starting, and it coincides with some environmental disasters like the oil spill in Santa Barbara, which happens in 1968. We also have, the river in Ohio where the river has become so toxic that it catches on fire. So these environmental problems are really starting to show themselves. And all of these things are combining, and the youth culture is looking to Native people as people who, well, maybe the Indians really did have it right after all. Their understanding and their connection to the natural world, they kind of knew what they were doing. And so we see this view start to seep into popular culture, and it really starts with the in 1971, the Keep America Beautiful campaign with the Crying Indian commercial that's so iconic and so famous at this point, where this Indian's dressed in, you know, traditional, buckskins and moccasins, and he's in a canoe and, you know, it looks like he's in his natural environment. And then the camera pans back and we see this, you know, toxic factory spewing smoke into the sky, and a car drives by and throws a bag of trash that lands on the Indian's moccasins. And, you know, the narrator says something about some people have reverence for the land and some people don't, or something like that. And then the Indian turns his head and there's a single tear rolling down his face. And so this becomes the symbol for the new environmental movement in the country. There was a problem with it though. And one of the problems, well, there was a lot of problems with it. One of the problems was that this Indian was no Indian at all. In fact, he was an actor who was a guy named Oscar Despero de Corti. I always forget the full name. Oscar Despero de Corti, or Iron Eyes Cody. That was his kind of professional name. And it's revealed that Iron Eyes Cody is 100% Sicilian guy. He's who has just taken on, he's been in a lot of roles and spaghetti westerns. He's just made a life. He's made an entire career out of impersonating an Indian. And so this sort of sets the stage for this environmental movement. But it also creates a really problematic stereotype. It's a new stereotype. So we've had all these negative stereotypes up until now. We've had the stereotype of the savage Indian, and the savage Indian takes all these different kinds of articulations. We have the drunk Indian, the degraded Indian, the ignorant Indian, the lazy Indian, the childlike Indian, all these things that we can name that are negative depictions of who Native people are. But now we have the ecological Indian, or the environmental Indian, and this ecological Indian is sort of the new noble savage. And the noble savage in this this manifestation has got a lot of baggage attached to him, a lot of expectations that, you know, their Indians are the original environmentalists. So it's imposing this sort of new category, this category of environmentalism, imposing that onto Native peoples, like Native peoples were had these environmental values. But it's a real kind of convoluted way of characterizing Native people who did have this relationship to the natural environment, but it's not like for it is for white people, juxtaposed to this other, you know, super intensive use of the land that involves extractive processes and, you know, putting the land to work for human and capitalistic use. So what it does is it sets up this impossibly high standard for Native people to live up to. And when they don't live up to it, it becomes just another setup for Indians to be denigrated in these American narratives. And again, coinciding that or putting that in context of what's happening with federal policy is that Native people are finally starting to get some self-determination. We have the federal government loosening again these constrictions on Native lands, and Native lands are being leased out to companies that are doing some of these extractive resource processes in order to generate revenue. So fostering a economic self-sufficiency on the tribal nations, that's where this was going. And, you know, Native people who were so often confined to some of the worst lands, or what settler people considered some of the worst lands, paradoxically, these lands turn out to be some of the richest in some of these substances in this new energy intensive society, you know, going back to uranium for one thing, but also coal. And so Native people on these lands with all this uranium, all this coal in particular, move in the direction of developing these resources because they're so poverty stricken. Indians have always been the poorest, the most poverty-laden people in the country. So Congress starts, you know, negotiating these leases on Indian lands to extract coal, and it becomes hugely problematic for the environmental movement, and it still is. But for Native people, it's a way to get themselves out of these conditions of grinding, crushing poverty. So it's this sort of impossible situation for Native people. Native people are going to be attacked. They're going to be seen as being incorrectly using the environment in the eyes of other people, no matter what they do, you know, from these different angles. So they end up, you know, even though there's this relationship of the counterculture to Indian people sort of revering Native people and their connection to the land and the values that they perceive to hold dear, when Native people are engaging in resource extraction, they are vilified for it by these same people. So, you know, it's these impossible standards that the ecological Indian stereotype. So we have to understand, you know, how these images that mainstream society has constructed Native people, because they've never really understood Native people to begin with, how those images are at play throughout all these different eras of American history and including today.
I'm speaking with Dina Gillia Whitaker, I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and we're talking about her book, As Long as the Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice, From Colonization to Standing Rock. So in the period since the 60s and 70s, when there was this surge of the environmental movement, how has that movement changed or not changed to the degree to which it recognizes the complex realities of Native people and also the struggles of Native people around environmental justice, which, as you highlight in the book, is a longstanding tradition?
I perceive that there is a change, especially in around the last couple of decades, the last 20 years or so, when I surveyed some of the literature in the environmental movement and the ways that it's engaging Indian country. I think there are times when the environmental movement directly worked against Native people in some of their projects, even to reclaim land. I mean, you have episodes of the Sierra Club blocking the reacquisition, for example, of land on the White Earth Reservation. And it also happened in Alaska with the reclaiming of land in one of the islands up there. And there are many other examples of these kinds of interferences where the environmental movement is really working against Indian country to revitalize their cultures and can reconnect to their traditional lands. But I think as climate change becomes more and more of a reality, and people see that they are just as much targets of big oil, for example, you know, the pipelines are a part of this, the building of pipelines, the way that non-native lands have been reclaimed through processes of eminent domain, as happened in Iowa during the Dakota Access Pipeline struggle. I think, you know, we've seen, that's when we really start to see, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s, we start seeing the coalescing of alliances between communities that were sometimes, you know, like white communities with Native communities who had previously been sort of enemies with each other. Now they're seeing that they're being treated the same way the Indians were treated in many cases. And so these alliances start forming all over the country. And I go to Zoltan Grossman's book called Unlikely Alliances. It was a really exhaustive study where he traces this genealogy of alliances building throughout this era, and how it culminates. We can sort of see this culminating in around 2015 with the Cowboy Indian Alliance that was so successful in convincing President Obama to not grant the permits for the Keystone XL pipeline. And certainly Standing Rock is also a really good example of the alliance building of the environmental movement with Indian country, and how much it spread. Also the Idle No More movement. So these, now that we're in an era of social media and the ability to organize beyond state boundaries, you know, state as in, you know, lowercase state United States and uppercase state as in nation state, we see the ability to organize globally, and how people have galvanized, how Indian country has galvanized their causes and been able to raise awareness of these things, because it's really apparent that we're all kind of at risk now. It's not just Indian country. You know, big oil, These extractive industries are causing the toxification of the entire planet everywhere you go. I mean, that's what climate change is. It's the rampant spewing of greenhouse gases, and none of that stuff knows national boundaries. So we're all affected by it now. The way I say it in the book is that we're sort of all on the reservation now. If that's a metaphor for the way people are rendered pollutable and expendable, it's pretty much we're all pollutable and expendable now. And when I see the recognition of that as being sort of a new fuel for these more powerful alliances between Native and non-Native communities. But as I write about in the book, we still see, and it was evident at Standing Rock, that there are still problems. There are ways that these deeply entrenched stereotypes and really ultimately white supremacy, it's the way white supremacy and white privilege still shows up in the environmental movement and can be obstacles for effective organizing and true allyship between these communities. And as I write about in the book, it really showed up in this gendered way at Standing Rock with the example of the women and the skirts, where there was a news story when it was happening at the time that non-Native women showed up to Standing Rock, which was really ultimately a ceremonial space in Lakota tradition, but showed up without skirts. And it was because they didn't know that in a situation like that, Native women are always, it's a space to, as a way of showing respect to wearing skirts. It's a way that Native tradition has always been pretty much straight across the board in most tribes in the United States. And these white women that showed up didn't know that. And so you had Bethany Yellowtail, who is a really well-known designer in Indian country, showed up with hundreds of yards of cloth, and Native women do the sewing brigade, and they sew all these ribbon skirts to give to the non-Native women who were there without skirts. And, you know, in the book, I talk about some of the interviews that I did with people who also experienced some of this, this sort of cultural conflict that was happening on the ground with women. So that's in a chapter devoted to women and their leadership in Indian country, not just in the Standing Rock incident, but throughout the history of organizing in the 20th century.
And I'm afraid we're entirely out of time and didn't do justice to that part of the book. But if you're interested, the book in question is As Long as the Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. The publisher is Beacon Press, and its author is Dina Gillia Whitaker. Dina, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your invitation.
Dina Gillia Whitaker is an educator in environmental justice policy planning. She teaches at Cal State University, San Marcos, and she is co-author with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz of All the Real Indians Died Off. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.